Where is this woman with that serenity? Hi, my name is Kathy Heekin, and I am recovering in Al-Anon. One day at a time, my home group is Mount Washington Tuesday night 12-step group. Hi, everybody. I really am so privileged to have been invited because to speak in front of so many of you is special because so many of you, as you know, are such a fundamental part of my recovery in this program. You were and you still are today, and I know you will be tomorrow, and I just thank you a lot for having been there for me. You know, it's funny because, like Peggy last night, I just came back from a vacation, and I took most of my kids with me, although not all of them. And along the way, I stopped and saw brothers and sisters of mine that dot the eastern seaboard. And it's funny when we talk about growing up, how different it was for so many of us. My perception of growing up in my home was that it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed where I grew up. My mother is a very dominant sort of personality, very efficient, very, you just always knew where she stood on things, and you still do today. My dad, on the other hand, is real laid back. He's just a real goofy kind of a guy, real funny, but he has a serious side, but for the most part, he has a tremendous amount of really bizarre humor, and I grew up really appreciating that bizarre humor. People would come to visit our home when we were kids, and I know they thought that we were strange, and we were, but it was a good strange. I mean, it was a fun place to be. I always felt very secure growing up, very loved. I'm one of six children. And I do know, being raised as an Irish Catholic, not only was our faith very important to us, but also humor was very, very important. I didn't have any, drinking alcohol was not a part of my family growing up. I know that we had relatives who had, who had trouble drinking. We never called them alcoholics. They were referred to as mean Irish drunks. I said to my mother once, "Mom, don't you think that maybe Grandpa was an alcoholic from all the stories that you tell?" And she said, "What? We didn't have enough money to be alcoholics. He was just a mean Irish drunk." And that's the way they looked at it. I don't know. It seems, from all the stories that I hear, I think it's there. And I don't know how important that is. I know what's important for me today is that I recognize, certain messages that I got. And I don't know that I got them so much from my parents, but I certainly got them from my church, and I know I got them from society. I was always taught to put yourself last, that you do for other people. And I grew up being very good at being able to know how you felt, and trying to figure out, what you thought. But I never really was very good about how I felt myself. As I say, growing up, humor played a real important role in my family. And so if anything happened, we really didn't have any crises growing up, but we always dealt with, everything that came up, we just laughed about it. I mean, we just would make jokes about things. I can remember telling a social worker that, and she looked at me as, she said, "What a strange way to grow up." And I was real defensive about that because I thought it may seem strange to you, but I really enjoyed it. Where I got into trouble is I never learned when not to be funny. I didn't learn when not to be funny and to get serious. I just thought, and that's the way that I went through life. If I got into trouble, I'd just tell a funny story, I'd talk my way around it, and I'd get out of it. I was a master at doing that. The nuns loved me, old ladies loved me. I'd break something to the neighbors, and I'd go and I'd tell them a funny story, exaggerate things, and it would be fine. And I skirted things all the time like that. And I still do. It's a form of dishonesty, although I never recognized it that way. I thought I was just being very entertaining. And sometimes I was. But also, I was also a liar, as it turns out. My mother used to always say to us, laugh and the world laughs with you. Cry and you cry alone. Self-pity got us nowhere growing up as kids. I mean, you just didn't do it. I mean, if you felt sorry for yourself from an instant, forget it. I mean, they'd be on you. What do you have to feel sorry about? It just didn't work. And so self-pity, anger was not a popular feeling in my family. Humor was. I mean, humor was just really, it was really important. Anyhow, I think that I grew up also when I grew up with a lot of nuns, and I really like those nuns. They taught me this very important phrase, which I carried with me for many years. It was joy. They used to say, Jesus, others, yourself. I got a very clear message, to put myself last. To take care of myself was somehow selfish, that somehow it was wrong. That I should always be, I should always be doing for other people. And I saw this operating in my house. I mean, I saw my mother do this all the time. And I thought that's what you were supposed to do. That's what you were supposed to do. That's what was important. That's what, you know, Christianity, that's what womanhood, so much of that, my idea of those two terms was about taking care of other people, making sure other people were comfortable, that they weren't embarrassed, that they weren't hurt, no matter what that took, no matter what that took. I mean, I would tell people, I would make up things all the time just to make you feel better. I thought that was being a good person. I thought that was honorable and noble. When I met my husband, he was quite possibly, I say this all the time, he was the most exciting man I had ever met. He was just out of the movies as far as I was concerned. He was in training to be a jet pilot. He was in the Marines. I'd never known a Marine in my life. He was just bigger than life. You never really knew what he was going to do. And for me, I thought that was really exciting. Because I'm not a boring person, but I'm a pretty predictable person. And here was somebody that was not at all predictable. Here was somebody, you never knew what he was going to do. He was just so challenging. He was just, you know, I can't explain him. He was just, well, he was crazy. But I didn't think he was crazy, you know. I was so attracted to that. He would do things I wouldn't do in a million years. I always followed the rules. I mean, that's what I learned. You follow the rules, you do what you're told to do, and things work out. He never followed the rules. I was fascinated by that. Never followed the rules. If there was a rule, he'd break it. I couldn't believe somebody was like that. I liked that. That to me was courageous. So he was living out, I mean, he was in training out of town. I'm living in Cincinnati. So we don't really spend a lot of time with one another. And so as a result, when things would occur, you know, when he would lose his temper, which he really did pretty often, I just assumed it was because we weren't living in the same city. I just assumed, well, you know, I'm here, he's there, this has got to be a problem of communication. But I wasn't concerned about that because I knew that once we were together, I would tell my stories, I would be funny, I would be charming, and he would be okay. Who could be mad? Who could be mad at me? Nobody used to get mad at me ever. I never got into fights with people. I hear people say, remember when you used to have a fight with your best friend? I never fought with my best friend. I never fought with anybody except for one brother that got on my nerves. That's it. And so I thought, this will work out. That was my whole experience. This will work out. I can do this. I can make this guy happy. He's just unhappy because he gets a lot of criticism, that's all. He's just unhappy because of this. He's just unhappy because of that. I'll fix it. The drinking I did not notice, to tell you the truth. And I didn't notice it because he used to drink, number one, out of a silver cup. He'd come to my house with a silver cup with bourbon in it. How classy. I mean, how classy. Who could worry about that? And secondly, he never got drunk. He never got drunk. And thirdly, he had a father who was just a well-known drunk. I heard about his father before I even met him. Just a well-known Cincinnati drunk. And I mean, who would ever repeat that kind of a pattern? Nobody. Nobody would. You know they wouldn't. So I was unconcerned. Just sure that I would make everything work. And I couldn't. And that's, you know, and that's what got me, is that I couldn't. I thought that I could, and I couldn't. And what I found in my marriage was that everything I knew to do, all the skills I thought that I had, didn't work. Didn't work. And that terrified me. It was as though somebody gave me a set of skis and a parka with a hood and gloves and snow goggles and then dropped me in the desert. I had nothing that worked. And that's the truth. Nothing that worked. Actually, I wasn't even sure I was going to marry my husband. He announced it one night at dinner in front of his entire family. And I was as surprised as they were. I mean, we had talked about, I mean, you know, we kind of talked about, you know, you talk about it. I talked about it just because he wanted to talk about it. If that's what he wanted to talk about, I'd talk about that. And then he announced it, and I thought, wow, that's really going to be quite a step. But, see, I didn't have the wherewithal to stand up in front of that group and say, oh, no, I don't think so. Oh, no, wait a minute, we haven't really discussed this. I thought, well, yeah. You know, we'd probably have done that anyway. Sure, we can do that. That's okay. I can do that. That'll work. See, now if I told you that story 15 years ago and you'd laughed, I'd say, why do those people think that's funny? It seems so logical to me. Today it seems so insane to me. I can't believe that, you know, I did it. But I did do it. And a lot of that, too, was, I mean, I was just so immature, so naive, and so really sick. I hate that adjective. When we were married, we moved immediately down to North Carolina, where my husband was stationed at the time. And I always tell this story, and I know many of you have heard it a million times, but for me it just exemplifies what went on for the next 12 years. 10 days into the marriage, I received a package in the mail, and it was glassware, and it was all packed in straw. And at the time we were living in a trailer camp, And not a fancy trailer camp either. It's just a very generic trailer camp. No grass, nothing. I mean, you know, concrete blocks to get into the thing. And I got this package, and it was addressed to both. This was a wedding gift, I was sure. You know, tore out the straw, took out the glassware, put it in the closet, and then took the package and threw it outside. When my husband came home, he was furious, just furious. I couldn't understand this. I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "That package was addressed to both of us, and you opened it. You've just violated federal regulations. You're not allowed to open up somebody else's mail." That's strange. I thought, well, what? But I immediately thought, maybe he's right. Maybe I am greedy. Maybe that's a side of me I've never known. Maybe I am greedy. Maybe now that you're married, you're supposed to do things together, and I just don't get it. And then he said, "Plus, you've got straw all over our side yard." And I said, "Well, yeah, I do." And he said, "You got to go pick that up." And I thought, he's nuts. He really expect me to go pick that straw? I mean, I felt like I was 10 years old. And I had just gotten married 10 days ago. But I thought, well, you know, I'll go along with that. I'll do that. I'll pick up the straw. How important is it? You know? How important is it? I'll pick up the lousy straw. So I went out and I picked up the straw as best I could. And I'm mad, you know, but I do it. And that's another pattern of mine. I'm mad, but I do it. And I come in to get into that trailer, and he's got that door locked. And he said, "You missed some." Well, I thought, forget that. I'm leaving. Now, here I am in Havelock, North Carolina. I don't know if any of you have ever visited Havelock, North Carolina, but at the time, in 1970, there wasn't anything there except for a Sears catalog store that didn't even have a chair. It was just a catalog book, and then a furniture store. So I headed for the furniture store. I didn't know where else to go. You know, 1,000 miles away from home, I didn't know where to go. So I go to the furniture store, and I walk around, and I think, what am I going to do? This is strange. This is really, something's really wrong here. And I had a terrible sense that what was wrong was big, and that I wasn't going to be able to fix it. That all my stories and all the way I'd snow people all the time and had all through my life, you know, dancing around, complimenting them, telling little jokes, you know, never being critical, you know, peace at any price, it wasn't going to work. I just knew it wasn't going to work. And I knew I was in over my head, and it scared me to death. It terrified me, and I did not know where to go. My first instinct was to protect myself. You got to get out of here. You're just going to have to go back to that trailer, and when he's gone, write a check, you know, to American Airlines and just disappear. I mean, just go back to Cincinnati. But then my second thought is, what are they going to say? The 11th day, I'm back. What am I going to say to my mom and dad? Oops, sorry, I made a mistake. I'll pay you back for that reception. What am I going to say? And then spend the rest of my life walking down the street and having people elbowing one another. There she goes, she's married 11 days, and then she came home. What a little idiot. I mean, I had my reputation to think of. You know, how is that going to look? How is that going to look? You see, that was very important to me. How do things look? I grew up with that. How does it look? You don't do things that are embarrassing. You're gracious, no matter what. You're always gracious. You don't do embarrassing things. How is it going to look? What will the neighbors think? What will the neighbors say? So forget that. So what I did instead was went back, picked up the straw, and hated myself. Thought he was an absolute loon, but hated me because I did it. But I didn't know what else to do. And that's pretty much what happened with the next 12 years. I never knew what to do. I just thought to myself, what do you do in this situation? And I never knew. I never had any answers. But I couldn't leave, because I just couldn't do that. You just don't leave. I mean, divorce, you know, that we don't even say that. It's not a word in my family. Divorce, that's not even, forget it. Forget it. The whole Catholic Church would have fallen apart if I had divorced. I knew that. I couldn't do that to the Church. Rome, it would have been a mess. The Vatican would have written me. It would have been awful. Forget that. You just make the best of what you got, that's all. And I have to say, it was not one nightmare after another. A lot of parts of it were wonderful. I spoke one time in a hospital, and this old man came up to me afterwards, and he said, "I'm so mad at you." And I thought, I said, "Really?" And he said, "Why did you stay? Why did you stay?" And I said, "You know, this was a man who was gentle, who was compassionate, who was funny, who was a funny man. Who was intelligent, who could do anything you could think of, he knew how to do it. Anything. He was more than just an alcoholic. He was more than that. But he did have these times when he would go off the wall. And I never knew what to do then. And I lived in fear of those times. I lived with that fear. You'd never know it. I didn't think. You'd never know it because I kept up the, you know, I was still funny. I was still telling stories. He was my best material. He was my best material. I used to go, he would do weird things. And I would quick go, change, oh, presto, turn him into a funny story. Go to parties, entertain people about my husband. He's so funny. It looked like it was good. But it wasn't because I was scared. And I was scared because of that fear. I was angry and resentful. And I did not know that. I did not know that. I did not know the depth of my rage, but I was angry because this was not what I had in mind. This was not what I had in mind. Honor, love, and correct. That's what I had in mind. I didn't have this in mind at all. I mean, I can remember thinking it was my duty. It was like a crusade, you know, to change his thinking on many things. When we got married, he had Vietnam ahead of him. He wasn't sure when those orders were going to come through, but we knew they were going to come through soon. And I used to sit there and tell him how unjust I thought the Vietnam War was, and blah, blah, blah. And he would just leap out of the bed and say, I can't sleep with the communists. And he'd go into the living room. He would go into the living room in the trailer and turn on Tammy Wynette. To this day, if I hear Tammy Wynette, I have to say to you got to turn it off. I can't stand it. Tammy Wynette, Stand By Your Man, blasting in this trailer. And I would think, Tammy Wynette. And that's what I, you know, and then I would feel badly. Then I would feel badly because I wasn't standing by my man. I couldn't stand there and proudly send him off to Vietnam. And I couldn't make him become a draft dodger. He was a Marine pilot. What was I thinking? All those things, you know, I just thought that I had the, I just thought that I knew what was best. Because I was so kind and loving and funny. And he was so angry. And so I had to know what was best. Because if I didn't, then I didn't know what I was doing, and I could never look at that. I could never look at that. If I didn't know what was best, then my whole life was predicated on a lie, and I could not face that. Didn't have the strength, didn't have the courage. He did get sent to Vietnam, finally, just 4 months after we were married. Oh, I was so happy. I was so relieved. That just sounds so terrible. And because it just, you know, isn't the way I had it, wasn't what I had envisioned when you got married, but that's the way it was. I just wanted him to get away for a while. It was just too intense for me. It was too intense for me. The feelings that I felt, you know, the fear, the anger, the resentment, it was just so much for me that when he told me, you know, those orders came through and he had to leave in May, it was almost like somebody told me I was going to get to go on a vacation, on a cruise. I just needed some breathing space. I needed to look at what was going on. And I think I thought that if I could just think about it long enough, if I could just intellectualize about it, I would straighten it all out and I would know what to do. I would be able to figure something. I'm a smart girl. I'd be able to figure out some sort of solution. That's a hard thing when you're living in on a Marine base and you're surrounded by wives who are all torn up because their husbands are going to Vietnam and you're happy. That's a hard game to play, to try to make it look like you too are distraught, because I wasn't distraught. And I have told people many times my hope for my husband was certainly not that he would get caught or shot down. Well, no. It was certainly not that he would be killed. But I did think that if there was any possibility that he was captured, it might be a good thing for him. It might be just what the doctor ordered. A little bit of torture, a little bit of getting scared might turn him around a little bit. Maybe he'd come back grateful and act right. He didn't, though. He didn't, and I should have known better. Those people never get caught. They never get shot down. No chance. It's all those nice, goony-looking guys. They get caught. My husband came back from Vietnam. We were still in the service. A lot of drinking in the service. If anybody, really, a lot of good drinking in the service, if anybody's interested. It's free, you know, it's cheap. You can get a lot of cheap drinks. And those guys drank a lot. I mean, they all drank, you know. My husband's drinking didn't stand out. They all drank, you know, the squadron parties, you know. They're falling over, you know, one guy, I don't know, fell into a radiator drunk, got second-degree burns. Everybody thought that was a scream. I just, strange. He didn't drink any more or less than anybody else. That's why today there are certain times, you know, I always listen to hear my pilot is, because I know a lot of those guys fly for, you know, Delta, you know, Northwestern. I hear a certain name, I'm getting off the plane. There's no way I'm flying with those idiots. Hate to tell you that, but that's true. And they still think they're all right today, and that's okay, I guess. But I don't have to fly with them. My husband's drinking. The only thing that was a little different about my husband's drinking is that when he drank, he got mean. He didn't get funny. He didn't fall on a radiator and burn himself. No, he got mean. And so this is what I would do. Somehow I thought that if I could just watch, if I could just keep an eye on how much he drank, it would be okay. Because I would get quieter in proportion to how much he drank. The more he drank, the quieter I became and the more watchful. I don't know why I thought that helped anything, but I did. So I watched him like a hawk. He never knew I was watching him. I was good. But I used to watch him at 5. I learned a lot of good things to do. When he would be drunk, I'd get in the car. I learned to put a seatbelt on. I learned not to say, "Rick, you're going 120 over the causeway." I learned not to say that because when I said that, then he'd go 140. I learned, don't say anything. Just be quiet. I didn't know I didn't have to get into the car with somebody that was drinking. Oh my God, it might hurt their feelings. I mean, it might embarrass them. It might cause some kind of conflict. I avoid conflict at all costs. I just got in, put my seatbelt in, was very quiet, and I prayed. God, let me get home, please. Just let me get home to all those babies at home, please, God. That's what I used to do, and I thought that worked. I have to say that eventually, of course, we got out of service. My husband decided to become a dentist. I couldn't tell you how that all happened, but that happened. And just before he left for dental school, he was badly beaten up, right here in Newport, Kentucky. A bouncer was not at all pleased with his behavior, and just did a number on his face. He had a little bit of plastic surgery. And then he didn't drink. Then that was it. He didn't drink for 3 years. We were in Columbus, Ohio State Dental School. He didn't drink for 3 years. Our life was wonderful. It was great. I thought, well, I guess all that stuff in the beginning of our marriage was just, you know, a period of adjustment. I guess now it's over. I guess now we're home free. This is great. This is wonderful. How could I have doubted? How could I have not believed that God would make it all work out? This is fine. Because I always did that. I wouldn't do anything, but I was always waiting for God to do something. God will come down and miraculously change this whole scenario, and that's what I thought turning my life and will over the care of God meant. I don't have to do anything. God will do it all. I just have to wait for God to take action, and a miracle will occur in my life. And actually, that's what did happen, but it just happened a different way. He didn't drink for 3 years when we were in Columbus. We came back to Cincinnati, and he immediately got into drugs. I didn't know he got into drugs. I missed that. I just thought he was going insane. He became addicted to drugs, and he did it. You know, he's an honest guy. He wrote himself those prescriptions. I mean, he didn't, you know, write out to himself to Dr. So-and-so, signed by Dr. So-and-so. And eventually, of course, the Reno agents caught him, arrested him, and he's kicked out of dentistry. I was so relieved when he told me he was a drug addict. Oh, I thought, oh, thank God. I just thought you were crazy. You're just a drug addict. Who cares? That's nothing. Just quit taking drugs. Oh, now we can get back to life. This is going to be great. We had 4 kids at that time. I thought, wow, now here we go. Now we'll start building a family. Whew, got that one behind us. I didn't know. And so after he was kicked out of dentistry, that was followed by years of unemployment, and that's what got me the sickest, because I have a tremendous fear of financial insecurity, and that just goes along with unemployment. It just fed right into it, you know. We didn't have anything. And the strange thing is, we are living as though we have everything. That's what's strange, because we're living in a home that is owned by his parents, on land that's owned by his parents, and it looks so good. I mean, it's got a river view, it's got tennis courts, it's got horses. I mean, you would have thought I was loaded. We had nothing. Nothing. Borrowing all the time, you know, borrowing from his mother here, there, doing little things he would do. Raise bees, sell the honey. That's a strange thing to do when you're a pilot, when you're a dentist. You need a license to sell real estate. You raise bees. But what is really hard was my part, because I had to make it look normal. That's what's tough. What does your husband do? He's a beekeeper? Not where I live. Didn't work. What does your husband do? He also trapped a red fox. He was a noted fox hunter. It's not hard to be a noted fox hunter when you live in the suburbs. In 1978, that'll get your reputation. Not a big market for fox furs, but that's what he used to do. And I used to, I worked so hard at making that seem normal. I worked so hard at making that all seem normal. To my kids particularly, when they would come home with, you know, the school, you know, they come up with all those forms for school, and it says husband's occupation. I used to think, what business is it of theirs? What business is it of theirs? Because I knew what I had to do. It meant that I was going to have to lie. I couldn't put down fox hunter. I put down independent businessman. What a joke. My kids would say, what does Dad do? What does Dad do? And I'd say, what do you mean, what does he do? Look what he does. He does everything. How would you like a boring lawyer for a father? I couldn't imagine anything worse. Or a banker or a carpenter. Oh, how boring. Your father's a fox hunter. He's a beekeeper. He's a maker of jellies and jam. What do you want? What do you want? Look at all the things that he can do. And that's the truth. My husband was a terribly talented man. He really could keep bees. That's hard to do. It is. I know you think I'm making a joke, but I mean, you got to wear that big hat with a net. I mean, when I used to see him walk down to that, whatever those things are, the hives with that hat and that net, I think, this is hard. This is hard to make seem normal. Even I knew it was crazy. But I wouldn't have told you that. I wouldn't have told you that because then you'd say, well, what are you going to do about it? And I didn't know. See, I didn't know what to do about it. I just did nothing about it. I just pretended like it wasn't going on. That's all. And my husband did not use drugs and alcohol at the end. He didn't. He just didn't. But the behavior was there in both of us. I mean, the behavior was there for both of us. I had a lot of resentments against my neighbors. I had a lot of resentments against my neighbors because my husband would keep steel leg hold traps around the house and they wouldn't let their kids play up by our house. I thought that was being a little ridiculous. How much can a leg hold trap hurt you? All you do to get caught in it is just open it up, let the kid out. Big deal. What's the matter with these women? I lived with the Stepford wives. They had no brain. I was very careful. My husband used to, a lot of times during this unemployment, when he would hunt from his bed. I thought, you know, he would lay with the bed, the window open, a gun next to his bed, watching the cartoons of a little squirrel or an unsuspecting little bird would get in that tree by that open window. He'd just reach behind him, pick up that gun, blow the thing right out of the tree. I was very careful. I would go out and say to the kids, don't play on that side of the house. Dad's hunting. Go on over there where it's safe. I was a responsible parent. I was conscientious. I didn't let anybody get hurt or shot. I could not protect the neighbor's cat. That was not my fault. I detached from his hatred of cats. I couldn't help it. If they couldn't keep their cats in the house, I couldn't help if he blew them into 1,000 pieces. I wasn't proud of it, but that wasn't my problem. There were things that were hard to keep down, though. I mean, I know today that my mother and father were very concerned. I did not know that. I thought I'd done a number on them. My brothers and sisters were concerned. My friends were concerned. I didn't know that. I just thought I was doing such a good job of making everything look normal. I had no clue as to how bizarre my life had become and how sick I was at trying so hard to look good and to be right. Those two things in themselves, being right and looking good, kill me. Did then, still big dangerous things for me today. They get me. They get me good. I have to be real careful with that. And so, things like that went on. And eventually, my husband's sister got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and very shortly after, a number of other members of his family began to recover, and that was pretty much the end of that game. That's pretty much the end of that game. Because I lived in a place where it was all family, it was like a family complex, and they would come up and be in my kitchen, and they would talk about this disease, and they would talk about it being a family disease. And I didn't want to hear that because I had been to so many places. I had been to priests. I had been to social workers. I had been to psychiatrists. I was in a prayer group that used to pray for me every week. I mean, I went to a psychic who was brilliant, as it turns out. I had been to so many things. I was tired. And I thought, I'm not going anywhere else. I'm not going anywhere else. That's fine that their husbands are all going to Al-Anon. I'm not going. I'm tired of all this. I'm not sick. I'm the only one that's normal. Why should I do something? Let him figure it out. I can't. But they talked about it being a family disease, and that concerned me, because at the time I was pregnant with my 7th child, and I thought to myself, if this is a family disease, and my kids get it, there goes my 8-year plan. My 8-year plan was based on the idea that my husband was 4 years older than I was, and that I expected to live 4 years longer than he did, so that at the end of my life, I was going to have 8 years of relative peace. Now that's crazy, but that's how I used to live. When I would run the sweeper upstairs, and I would be crying, because I was always crying because my husband didn't work, we'd get no Social Security, and I'd have to go to Findlay Market when I was 65 and pull out old vegetable leaves in order to eat. So I thought about that all the time. So I'd be running the sweeper, and I'd be crying, because we had no money, and we had no Social Security, and what was I going to do, and we had all these babies, and was I crazy? And then I would think, oh well, I'll have 8 years. 8 years at the end of my life where it'll be okay. And then I'd dry my eyes because God knows, you can't feel sorry for yourself. That's so bad. And then I'd go on. And then, that's what I would do. So at any rate, that 8-year plan, when that was threatened, I thought, you just better go find out what's going on. Plus, I have to say, I love my sister-in-laws. Love them. Always did. Loved them when they were sick. Loved them when they were well. I always liked them. And I knew that they were going to be talking about this stuff for a while, and I wanted to be able to talk to them about it too. I mean, I wanted to be in on it, you know? I wanted to learn the little language, you know, and they'd give these little key phrases. I wanted to, you know, get the punchline. So to make a long story short, I did. I went to Al-Anon. I went to an Al-Anon meeting that was so far away from my home. Because how would that look? I mean, what is that saying about your husband to go to an Al-Anon meeting? You know, of course, I thought it had everything to do with him, nothing to do with me. How would that look? So I went to an Al-Anon meeting that was so far out of the city, they checked your passport when you got there. I mean, it was just way, way, way far away, and I hid there for a long time. But I have to say that the first time I went to that Al-Anon meeting, they told me that alcoholism was a disease and that I didn't cause it, that I couldn't cure it, and that I couldn't control it. And I knew I had never caused my husband's sickness. I knew that. But I always thought, with everything I had ever learned in my life, that I should be able to cure it. That's what you did as a loving wife. If you love somebody faithfully enough and loyally enough, and if you were really true, I mean really, really true, he'd be fine. Your husband would be fine. You could fix him, because love conquers all. Love conquers all. The power of love. You know, I believed all that, and it just didn't work. When that woman told me that, I immediately felt relieved. I immediately felt relieved. And I think I felt relieved because deep down in my heart, deep, deep down in my heart, I always knew that this wasn't my fault. I always knew somehow that this wasn't my fault. What I didn't know was how sick I had become. I did not know that. I did not recognize that. And until I recognized that, my own recovery never began. And she said to me that very first night, I kept saying, well, I don't really know if my husband's an alcoholic. I mean, he's a terrible drinker, but he doesn't drink anymore. And Alan, he was a drug addict, but I think he's over that. And she said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Forget about him. You are here for you. You're here for you. And that made sense to me. And then I went out to the meeting where other men and women, where you were, and you were all laughing, and you were just, I mean, having a nice time, and you were discussing things sensibly, and you were saying things like you chose, I thought, choice. Well, I know I heard that word before once, choice. Something about freedom of choice. You chose not to get into a car with somebody that drank. You chose not to do that. You chose not to go, you know, not to fight, not to argue, nor retaliate. I didn't know you could not do that. I thought I was supposed to do that because I was the keeper of truth and I was the keeper of justice, and I had to correct him or he'd go off the deep end. You know, he'd go down the wrong path, and it was my responsibility as a wife to correct him, make sure he stayed on the right path. But you told me I didn't have to do that, that I was responsible for myself. I didn't know that. I never knew that. And I have to say, honestly, I used to say, oh, I got in this program because I couldn't go on any longer. And that's not true. I could have gone on a lot longer. I could have stayed out there for years, because I know men and women that are out there, and they do it somehow. But what I found when I came in was the price I was paying. That's what I discovered. Because the price to pay to continue to play the kind of sick game that I was involved in was my humanity. That ultimately was my price. I had to give up my humanity because I couldn't feel, I couldn't be honest, I could not be intimate, couldn't be loving. That's the price that I had to pay in order to stay out of this program. And it was just too high for me anymore. But you taught me that it was too high because I saw the way that you were living. I saw that you were willing to go to any lengths to recover, and I liked that, and that's why I kept coming back, because you were there. That idea of powerlessness, of, you know, my of being powerless over alcohol, my life had become unmanageable. I didn't see that right away. I came to see that over a period of time, by going to meetings, by reading the literature. A woman came up to me after the meeting once, Florence, and she said to me, you know, Kathy, you'll never get better until you admit that you're sick. And I thought, oh, what do you know, you goof? Sick? I'm not sick. I've done so well. I've hung in there for 12 and a half years. That looks pretty good, Florence. Thank you very much. But, you know, I knew she was right. I knew she was right. I called my sponsor once, and I said, you know, they keep talking about being insane and being sick. I don't feel insane. I mean, I don't feel like I'm ready for, you know, a straitjacket. And she said, well, think of this. What about being sick with fear? You know, what about being sick with anger? What about being sick with resentment? Does that ring any bells with you? And of course it did. That I could relate to. That I knew was there. But not immediately. After a while.
A friend of mine who did a fifth step with a priest who's not in the program told me that he had said to her, gee, alcoholism has really hollowed you out. And I've always held on to that phrase because that indeed is what alcoholism did to me. It just hollowed me out. I mean, I was just shell-shocked when I came in those doors. I didn't know what I thought, I didn't know what I felt, because I had stopped feeling a long time ago, and what I was thinking was so unrelated to the reality of my life, it was just bizarre. I had been living so long with, you know, trying to hold on to values that I believed in, and just living absolutely contrary to those values. I believed in truth, and I lied. You know, I believed in loyalty, and I was being disloyal constantly, just constantly. I mean, you know, my husband was the butt of my best jokes. And I wasn't telling jokes in a compassionate way. They were in an angry way. It was sarcasm. You know, I could just slice him up with my tongue and thought I was justified in doing that. So, you know, coming to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, that for me means, as it did then, you know, I really believe that we restore things of value. And somewhere along the line, I had forgotten that I was of value. I'd forgotten that. I lost sight of that. And that I really could be restored, and that God would do for me what I could never do for myself. And that word insanity, I mean, there were times, you know, when I would be enjoying myself, but I thought that if my husband saw me enjoy myself, he would continue with the same kind of behavior. So whenever I knew he was coming, I'd pretend like I wasn't enjoying myself. If I was in the kitchen reading a book and he'd come in, I did this. I threw the book in the oven fast because I didn't want him to see that I was reading a book. I wanted him to think that I was scrubbing the floors. And, you know, I would do all those kinds of things. One time we were at a restaurant and he wasn't talking to me, which was a common thing. He would just not talk to me. And I would never know why. And I would never ask because I didn't want to know. And so he wasn't talking to me. We're at this restaurant with, you know, and he's got his head down and he's eating his meal. And I saw neighbors of ours who were across from the restaurant. And they, of course, were engaged in this animated conversation. And I thought, oh, God, they're going to see me and they're going to see me that I'm not talking to my husband. So when he would put his head down, I would go like this. And then when he'd pick his head up, I'd see another big time. Because I wanted it to look like it was okay. Now, that's insane. If you told me you did that, I'd say you're insane. But it took me to come into meetings to recognize that's crazy behavior. That's just off-the-wall stuff. I didn't know that. Made a decision to turn my life all over to the care of God, as I understand Him. I'll tell you, you know, that for me has come to mean different things. I used to think turning my life all over to the care of God meant turning my life all over to the care of God so that God would take care of me and I could be happy and I would be fine and my life would be great. And I'm beginning to see, as I'm in this program longer, that it has everything to do with being useful. That's, to me, is what the third step is. And the only way I know to do it is to do it, is to get down on my knees every morning and to say the third step prayer from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I do. I have to say, though, you know, my idea of God's will has also changed. I always thought God's will was something awful and terrible. Because when I was growing up, when some major tragedy would strike, people would say, well, it must be God's will. And so God's will for me was always connected to some awful thing, you know. If you really turned your life over to the care of God, if you really turned your life over to God's will, you'd for sure end up, you know, in El Salvador, you know, with your fingernails being pulled out. I was sure that's what God's will always meant, you know, martyrdom. And I don't know how much that has to do with growing up in the Catholic Church, but I think it probably has a lot to do with it. I mean, God's will always to me meant martyrdom, you know, torture, pain, agony. And so I was reluctant, as you can imagine, to ask for God's will in my life because I knew it was going to be bad, whatever it was. But you taught me differently. You taught me differently that God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. And that doesn't mean that it's not going to involve pain, but it also means that it's good. You know, God's will for me is good, and I didn't know that. I didn't know that. One time, my husband and I decided to take our kids to this water park in Indiana, and I said to him, look, if we're going to do this, let's not tell them where we're going. Let's just not tell them where we're going, because if we tell them, they'll all argue, they'll all want to bring pillows, they'll want to bring toys, they'll want to bring guests, they'll have a million excuses why they can't go. Let's just pack the car up and the next day tell them we're going to go on a picnic and we'll surprise them. It'll be a mystery. It'll be a mystery trip. So that's what we did. Well, the next day, and I'm so excited for my kids because they're going to love this water park. My kids like dangerous things. I always say anything that can kill them or maim them, they want to do. They love that kind of stuff. And this was it. You know, it was a pool with tidal waves. They would love it. So, and the next day we had the car all packed, and we said to the kids, come on, let's get in the car. We're going to go for a drive. None of them wanted to go. None of them wanted to go. No, I've got to play baseball. No, I'm going to go to a friend's house. And I was getting real frustrated. I said, come on, you're really going to love this. Trust me, you're going to love this. Just get in the car. I'm going to take you somewhere. You're going to love it. You're going to have so much fun. No, they want to get in the car. Well, finally, you know, we intimidated them and they got in the car. But I often think with the third step, you know, all I have to be willing to do is to get in the car. I don't have to drive it. I just have to believe that the driver is going to take me somewhere that's going to be fun and that I'm going to love it. That the driver knows more than I do. That the driver knows more than I do. And that for me is turning my life and will over to the care of God. That's a big part of it. And to know that somewhere along the line, hopefully, you know, just one day at a time, you know, I'll be of service, I'll be useful to somebody. I don't know. I just don't know. My idea of God has changed a lot since I've been in the program, too. I used to think of a God as, you know, of doing things right. If you did things right, you followed the rules, you went to Mass on Sundays, you know, all those things, you know, the stations, da-da-da-da-da. You know, you were respectful, you didn't cause fights, you fought. Then God loved you. Then God loved you. Then because God was a God of success. And what I have found is the God of my understanding today is not a God of success, but much more a God of failure. Because that's when I have really felt loved by God, is when I have failed, when I couldn't do it, when I have just simply couldn't do it. In my brokenness, that's when I have found God. That's when God has really spoken to me. And so that has changed. That has really changed for me. Nothing really, however, turned things as much for me as when I did a fourth step. And the only reason I did it is because you did it, and I saw that you were getting better, and I wasn't. I wanted what you had, and when I listened very closely, things that made it different was that you had a sponsor, and you had done a fourth step, and so I said, I want to do that, because I want to get better. I want to be just like you guys, and that's what you were doing, so I did it. I didn't do it because I'm a particularly honest person, I just did it because I wanted to get better. And what I found through doing the fourth step is that everything that I had once thought was just not the way things were. The fourth step forced me to change my mind. You know, when I could list my fear, anger, and resentment and see my part in it, I had never been able to do that before. I never saw before how my insistence on being right, on my insistence on how things looked, how things appeared, continually brought me harm and how I would bring harm to people around me that I loved. I never saw a lot of things until I took a fourth step. I just never saw it. And I thought that I was always an honest person, and I wanted to be an honest person, but the first three steps gave me the courage, I guess, to take the fourth step. That's what happened. Because I derived a lot of serenity just from doing those first three steps for a while. The key phrase for me early in my recovery was, one of you taught me, you could be right. Oh, I just love that, because I would go home and I could see a fight brewing and my husband would say, and I would say, you could be right. And that was the end of that. And he was stunned, because normally I would stay there and I would argue and I would have to make him see that he was wrong, and I would get into it and I would get mad and I'd feel frustrated that I hadn't changed his mind and he's such an idiot and how hard-headed. And then you said, you don't have to do that. You can just say you could be right. And that ended that. That was a dramatic change in our family life. You could be right. And I have to be honest, I used to torture him with it. It was great fun because I loved to fight. And I would say, honey, you could be right. And then I'd walk out of the room and I'd go, suffer, you devil. Anyway. But, you know, so that for me, that fourth step was just, you know, that's when things really changed. That's when I really knew that I was sick. When I really began to take responsibility for the alcoholism in me. And the fifth step, you know, admitted to God, to another human being, to myself, to God, and another human being, the exact nature of my wrongs. That's when I knew I was serious about this program. For me, the fifth step was like going public, you know? It was, all right, I'm in it. I want to get better, and this is the step I got to take, and I'm going to do it, and I just, you know, and I want to get better. I heard a man say not so long ago, when I tried to solve my problems, when I kept my problems to myself, my solutions were always worse than the original problem. And when he said that, I thought, isn't that the truth? When I kept secrets, when I tried to keep all this to myself and figure it out, because I'm so big on intellectualizing things, you know, I'm just so big on, if I can just intellectualize it, it'll go away. And I thought that, if I could just, you know, if I could just figure out this thing, figure out the right thing to say, the right thing to do, everything would work out. And it just, you know, it just made things even worse. And so a fifth step for me is share with God, with myself, with another human being, the exact nature of my wrong. I mean, I really had a sense that I was on the road to the right place. To become entirely ready to have God remove my defects of character. You know, I have to say it, I'm still fearful that God's going to remove some part of me that I really enjoy. You know, I've heard this in meetings a lot, and I can identify with that. I just love some of my defects. I think they give me character. I think they're kind of cute. I don't want to lose them. But I'm beginning to see that I won't lose them until they get in my way. Someone just said to me, those defects aren't going to be removed unless they're getting in your way of being useful. And I think that is true. I used to lifeguard all the way through college. That's how I got through college. I used to lifeguard in the summer and in the winter. And I can remember when I used to lifeguard in the summers at swim clubs. And there are some well-meaning parents, I'm sure, that really believed the best way to teach a kid to swim was to take him and throw him in the deep end. I don't know. I just never understood that method of education. But some people do that. I have to say that as long as I've been in this program, I have never felt like I have been thrown in the deep end and left alone to struggle to decide. Never. I have been in deep water before in this program, but you have always been there. You have always been there with the tools, and I have always known you'd be there, you know, with a life jacket, with the ring, with the pole, whatever. And that makes an enormous difference, because the lessons that I've learned in Al-Anon so far, some of them have been painful, but none of them have been shattering. None of them have been shattering since I've been in. And I know that has to do with God's love that you allow to come through yourselves to me. I know it is. And so being entirely ready for me is not so difficult, because my experience in this program is one of security and one of love, and things do just keep getting better. And I know I'm well taken care of. I know that I'm well taken care of. And I know that God will not do for me. I mean, that God will do for me what I can't do for myself, as well as that God will not do for me what I can do for myself. And so for me to be, you know, to ask God humbly to remove these defects of character, I have begun to see that I can't make myself more loving. I can't make myself more patient. I don't know how to do that. All I can do is to be willing and to cooperate with the grace of God in my life. When I had to make a list of people that I had harmed, that was difficult, because I really didn't think that I had harmed anybody. I really didn't think that I had harmed anybody, but I could look at that fourth step and see certainly that my relationships had been harmed. My relationship with myself, primarily my relationship with my husband, my kids, oh my gosh, my kids, friends, people that I had put distance between, a lot of those relationships had been harmed. And I needed to make amends for my dishonesty. I needed to make amends for my stubbornness, for my insistence on having things my way, which I never knew. Never knew that. Alcoholism is something that happened to our family. My kids play soccer, and I don't know, I don't understand the game at all. All I know is they're trying to get this white ball in the net. For years, I mean, I've had all these soccer games, 2 and 3 a weekend. It's just crazy. I don't know what's going on, because I don't like soccer. I don't pay much attention to it. But I know they're trying to get a white ball in the net. Last fall, one of my kids is playing soccer, and this young ref blows the whistle, and he stops everything, and he says, "Dangerous situation, no one at fault, resume play over there." And I thought, I love that call. I love that call. Dangerous situation, no one at fault, resume play over there. You know, that for me is an important part of my program. Alcoholism was not anybody's fault. It happened to everybody in my family. It happened to my husband, happened to me, happened to my kids. I never meant to hurt my kids, nor did my husband. He adored me and adored my children. But you know, we had the disease of alcoholism. And I'm responsible today for recovering, but I'm not responsible for having had it. I didn't choose it. I didn't choose it. Who would choose that? And so making the list, you know, I had to make that list and become willing. And I was afraid that I would never really be willing to make amends to my husband, because there were a lot of things. There were just a lot of things. But the more I believed, the more I could go into that fourth step and understand how much my part in it, for hanging around, you know, simply for accepting behavior that was unacceptable because I was too afraid, because I didn't know how to stand up on my own 2 feet. And when I learned to do that, I had to go with that. I had to be willing to change. And I'd be, you know. I think for me, the best way to make amends to my children was to recover. They were real little when I got into the program, as I said. You know, there were 6 little ones and pregnant with the 7th. And I think for me, the best way was just to get to meetings and to recover. And that's what I did. And that was not always easy, because there were a million reasons I should be at home. A million reasons. I mean, there were just all kinds of things. Primarily, my kids were afraid of their father. And my big job, of course, was to stay at home and to protect my children from their father. Not that they would hurt them, not that he would hurt them, although he could and did, but that I was the interpreter, I was the family interpreter. I had to interpret for them what he was saying, and I had to interpret for them, for him, what they were saying. I mean, and if I wasn't there to do that, what would happen? Someone's feelings would be hurt. I couldn't stand that, you know. You told me that that was not my job, that I had to get out of there. You told me that, and I did not really believe you, I have to say. I just did it because you said, do it, and I did it. I just did it because that's what you said. I thought you were probably wrong, but you weren't. You weren't. I got out of there, and I just left, and I would go down that driveway, and I'd see sometimes my kids lined up at the window looking at me like, you've got to be kidding. You're leaving us with Genghis Khan? What, are you a mad woman? How can you do this? But I had to go because I had to get better, and I had to be willing to get my kids to Alateen. And that was scary because that was interpreted as being my turning the whole family against their father. And that's not really what I intended, but I knew my kids needed at least the opportunity to get into a 12-step program. Some of them chose it and some of them rejected it, and that's okay. Because you also told me that everybody has the right not to recover. And I thought you were wrong about that too, but you weren't. You were right. Everybody does have the right not to recover, and it's none of my business. I think just, you know, getting better naturally, it certainly affected my relationships with my parents. I could be more honest with my friends, with my family. And I don't know, miraculously one day I made amends to my husband. It just was there. I was just willing to do it. And I felt like it was the right time to do it, and I wanted to do it. And I was sincere about it. And, you know, I had not been sincere with my husband for a long time. I was like that Saturday Night Live skit, you know, Mr. Subliminal. Honey, can I help you, you lazy dog? Why don't you get a job? Honey, you know, let me fix this dinner for you. You must be hungry. You must be hungry. That's all you do is sit around and shoot foxes. I mean, you know, I was always saying one thing and thinking another. It was insane. But I was sincerely, you know, I could sincerely make amends to him at one point, and that's only because of the grace of the program. That was a gift that was given to me. I certainly didn't earn it or work on it, but it happened. My husband used to have this hobby of flying these, because he was a former pilot. He liked, and he really loved doing this. It was a thing that he built, actually. It's a gyrocopter. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's got a little motor in the back and a set of blades, and then you sit on this lawn chair and you fly up in the sky. I always thought it was a little strange, but you told me that he was doing the best he could, and I believed you. I believed you. And so there were times before I got in this program, and even when I was in the program, when he would go off to fly on the weekends, and I'd think, daggone, there he goes, and here I am stuck with seven little kids, you know, running to soccer, and you said, Kathy, you know, you can be right, you know, you can be right, or you can be happy. What do you want to do? And then I learned to take care of myself. And I learned to take care of myself and do something fun. One day in May, a few years ago, though, he went off to fly, and it was blue sky, Memorial Day weekend, gorgeous. And I never thanked you for this. Because of you, you told me, you know, you told me that he was doing the best that he could. And I believed you. And I said to him, Ricky, what a beautiful day to fly. Have a ball. And those were the last words I ever spoke to my husband, because 2 hours later, the county police were at my door to tell me he'd been killed in a fatal crash. And I never thanked you for that. And I thank you today, because that means a lot to me. And if I hadn't said that, if he had left that day and I had griped and complained and whined, that would have been okay too. But I didn't, because you told me that I didn't have to live that way anymore. Shortly after my husband's death, my son got involved with drugs and alcohol, and you helped me with that too. And he went, you know, downhill pretty quickly, and that was tough. You know, that was tough again, you know, to keep out of it. But if I continue to take daily inventories, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it, I'm beginning to see what's my son's problem and what was my problem. It doesn't look good. It doesn't look good when your son goes to jail and he's only 15. It looks like you did something wrong. And you told me I didn't. You told me he was alcoholic and he was just out there right in his lead. And you told me that God's in jail. You said, God's in jail? What do you care? And I thought, oh, that's right, God's in jail. At least I know where he is. He's getting 3 meals a day. It's safe in there. It's warm. He's with people who are taking care of him. This will work. This is all right. But, you know, I could see myself 12 years before putting a 15. I didn't put him in jail. He got there, you know. I allowed him to go. He said to me once, I can't believe you put me in jail. I said, Mark, I didn't put you in jail. You put you in jail. I just let you go. I decided not to send you to that boarding school in New England where they work on kids with poor self-images. Because people in the program said, Kathy, you know, AA is free.
hey, it's free. I mean, you can go ahead and spend 10 grand a year on tuition, but just remember in the back of your head that it's 10 grand free, you know, that AA is free. And I have to say, because of my thing with financial, I thought, well, this is a better deal. Let's just send them to jail in AA. That seems a lot, you know, economically speaking, that sounds better to me. I don't know. Maybe if you got 10 grand to throw away, you can do those things. Maybe they work. I don't know. But I know what worked for my son was jail. It was great. He said to me once, you know, I really feel like I found God in jail. I thought, well, good. That's good. And you see, then I could love him. Then I could love him. That's what you said. Then you can love him. You don't have to worry if he's going to, you know, if he's going to 90 meetings in 90 days. You can just love him. Don't worry about his recovery. God's in, it's between him and God. You can just love him. You can laugh when you go to his room and you can see his big book and you open it up to read a page and you see that he has carved out the inside of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and there is your missing second set of keys to your car. You can laugh at that because that's okay. That's okay. You can laugh when you take him to the Crone Conservatory and realize when he's talking about buying a plant for his room that he used it to hide marijuana to sneak into the hospital. That was funny. I looked at it, I thought, what an ingenious kid. I could do that because you told me I wasn't in charge of his recovery. So he could screw up left and right and I could still love him. And that's another thing you gave from it to me. And I have to keep hold of that as my kids get older and go out there and do a lot of things that I just don't know why they do them. But I don't have to. I don't have to know why they do them and I don't have to make them not do them. I have my rules and I have consequences, but I don't have to predicate my love on how my kids act. And that is a gift of this program. But I can only do that when I take daily inventory, either written or by staying in touch with people in the program every day and going through these things, talking it out. I walk with a very close friend of mine who's in the program, and that's so helpful to me. We talk things out, you know? I mean, it's important for me. When I'm wrong, promptly admit it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. You know, that to me is something that I still struggle with because I got to take time. I got to take the time out of my day. I went to an old priest one time who said to me, you know, and I was talking to him about my lack of formal prayer, and he said, don't you know that when you live in the presence of God, that is prayer? And I do believe that, and I think that's true. But me, I also have to have a block of time where I can be quiet and where I can become rooted in that prayer. And as I say, you know, I start the morning on my knees, and that's helpful. But then I get up off my knees and I go to swim. At 5:30 in the morning, an ungodly hour, somebody says, why do you do that? I do it because that's when I pray. I put my head underwater at that Y, and for 35 minutes, I just go back and forth. Most boring exercise in the world. Terrible boring. But that's when I pray. Sometimes I just go up and down that lane and say, God, you know, relieve me of the bondage of self, so I better do your will. Sometimes I just say the serenity prayer. Sometimes I say, who is that idiot in the other lane, that goofy baby who's trying to beat me? I'll show him I'm faster than him. I mean, you know, sometimes I don't stick with that. But for the most part, that's a quiet time in my day, and that's important. And I have to have it. Because when I don't have it, it makes a difference. It makes a difference. I talk so much. The other thing is, lastly, I guess, that having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I never had any one clear spiritual awakening, God knows. I never did have one moment where everything became clear. But I know this. When my kids lose something in the house and they get very upset, I'll say to them, don't worry. When I get this place cleaned up, I'll find it. That's what I think about my spiritual awakening. When I go through those first 11 steps, the clarity and the serenity that I have been given allows me to be much more aware of God in my life. In June, I had a root canal work done. Oh, it hurt so badly. And as I left, the dentist said to me, here's a prescription for pain. I scoff at prescriptions for pain. I took it, stuck it in my pocket, walked out, didn't pay any, didn't go back to it. 3 weeks later, the dentist calls me, how's your tooth? I said, you know, I hate to complain. I hurts like crazy, still. He said, did you take the prescription? I said, oh. Oh, yeah, the prescription. I went and got the prescription, took this thing for inflammation. 24 hours later, my tooth felt fine. Why do I, you know, it's the same way with this program. I have the prescription. I have the prescription. And if I want to be out of pain and I want to feel better and I want to achieve some serenity and usefulness, I know what to do. Sometimes I don't, though. Sometimes I just put it in my pocket and, you know, forget about it because I think I'm doing pretty well. And I always end up back where, you know, I always end up back where I started from. When I swim, there's a thing on the wall in tile that says, do not swim alone.
this fellowship of Al-Anon, as well as AA, because a lot of my strength comes from my sisters and brothers in AA, I have to say, you know, alcoholism led me to self-pity and to isolation. This program of Al-Anon has led me into compassion and community, and that means a lot to me. I had to study this thing on India this summer, this course on India, this very famous, I guess, Indian proverb says, all that is not given is lost. And I believe that's true, and that's why for me to carry the message is always absolutely an honor, absolutely an honor. A friend of mine, two of my high school friends and I, the three of us, have been privileged to, you know, give mini leads at a halfway house. And I'm telling you, when we leave, we just, I mean, we're going down the street and we just are like grinning because we are so, I mean, how did we get so lucky? How did we get so lucky to be privileged to witness the power of God in people's lives? Not for a minute do I think that really anything that I say makes any difference, but just to be able to witness people in recovery, for me, is just such a blessing. And so when people, you know, say, will you do this, will you do that, will you go here, will you go there? Absolutely. It's my pleasure. How could I say no? I couldn't. How could I say no? I mean, it's just such a, I don't know, it's just such an honor to see God at work. It really is in other people. I also believe, you know, sometimes I can be dangerous too. I mean, one time I went down to, you know, the cat house and I did this meeting, this beginner's meeting. There's only one woman there, and I was pretty sure, you know, I was in one of those, I'm pretty sure I can help this woman, you know. So I didn't share with her at all. I lectured her for 20 minutes. And when I was finished, I said, now, do you have any questions? And she said, yeah, I want to know why my husband's here. I said, well, doesn't he have a drinking problem? She said, drinking problem? He works construction. So he comes home every day and drinks a six-pack of beer. I do too. I said, oh, well, I guess it's time to go now. I guess I'm, she said, I don't see a problem with that. I said, well, maybe there's not then. Want to go to Frisch's? You know, I got to watch that. You got to remember that, you know, it's to carry the message and that we, you know, just carry the message and that we're not the message ourselves. I know, too, for me, you know, certainly to practice these principles in all my affair, that just happens. I mean, that just happens. I don't know how to detach what I believe today from how I live. I just don't know how to do that. I slip back easily. I mean, I went after a kid the other day with my hand, and he turned to me and he said, is this what they teach you in meetings, to beat children? That's right. You know, they keep me pretty honest, those kids. They, of course, you know, they make fun of the program. They have great fun with it. I was telling somebody in my home group the other day, I said, one of the kids, fix my hair. They said, we can't fix your hair. Your hair's a disease. We can't control it. We can't cure it. We didn't cause it. They're so bad. But they'll, you know, I have schedules for them all when they call, as they will, and want to know where to go to get better. I mean, we go to Mass, we give the handshake, you know, you give the handshake a piece, say, peace be with you. My kids say, hi, I'm Julian, I'm an alcoholic. And they all fall down in the pews. They think they're so funny. They just love it. They just love to make fun of it. But that's okay. You know, that's where they are. Anyway, that's it. I don't have anything more to say. I do know that... I will tell you what I usually end with, and because it is important for me, because I have learned so much from you, that this program of recovery is for me. You know, I got real sick, and this 12 steps of Al-Anon, the program of Al-Anon, have really allowed me to become better. I've just got a lot of ways to go, but it's allowed me to become better. My mother and father don't understand it at all. They're just baffled by it. What do you say to people? I mean, what do you do? My mother says, Kathy, why do you keep going to Al-Anon when Rick is dead? And I say, Mom, I keep going because I'm not. And that's the truth. Thank you very much.